Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, a mother reflects on committing her son for his addiction.
I believe that the way he was treated was inhumane. I would equate it to almost being a prisoner of war. He was not treated with dignity and respect. He did not receive any sort of addiction treatment while he was there.
And what's the impact of college closures on local economies?
I think of specifically there's a pizza shop owner that knows he's going to lose hundreds of thousands of dollars just based on this one small little college of 400 students.
Also today, now that we have a summary of the Mueller report, should Democrats and the media apologize for all the hype?
If you want to look at the projectile pundits on cable news, you know, they definitely overreacted. But it's important to separate the news people from the opinion people.
It's all next on Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Every year, thousands of people in Massachusetts ask a court to force a loved one into addiction treatment under the state law called Section 35. We're one of the few states that uses prisons to house the men who are involuntarily committed. About 3,000 of those men have been committed to the Massachusetts Alcohol and Substance Abuse Center at a minimum security prison in Plymouth since it opened 2 years ago. But the safety and quality of treatment at these facilities are in question. WBUR's Deborah Becker spoke to Sean Wallace, who was sent to the Plymouth facility after it opened. In a 2017 interview, Wallace described what he went through as, quote, torture. He suffered methadone and drug withdrawals and was placed in segregation.
I was having delusions. I hadn't slept in so long that I wasn't doing well at all. And I was punished for not eating. That's how I ended up in the hole. If you refuse your tray, they consider it a behavioral issue. I didn't know that. I'm just sick.
Now, his family says they believe his time in prison led to him taking his own life last summer. Earlier today, we spoke with Sean's mother, Robin Wallace. She began by telling us about her son.
Sean was somebody who, as a kid, I'm sure that you hear this a lot, you know, he was good in school, he was good in sports, he was an easy kid to be around. He did have a little anxiety, and he had a little, I don't know if it was actually OCD, but he was very particular about being clean and having things the way that he thought that they should be. And when he got to be about 15 years old, he started to drink alcohol and experiment with drugs. And I think it was at that time that he became addicted to Percocet, prescription pain pills.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that was the big addiction for him.
And so what precipitated you seeking involuntary treatment for him then under Section 35? Was it that addiction to Percocet?
It was addictions to opiates. At that time, he had progressed to heroin. And he also, his behavior was erratic. I think that he had some mental health issues that were worsened by his use. And we had sectioned Sean in the past. I used to work at a Section 35 program for women. I used to be a clinical director at the WATC program in New Bedford. And I didn't have any concerns at that time regarding Section 35. I thought it was safe, and I thought that he would be well cared for.
So you say you worked, you know, in addiction treatment, and so I'm curious then, you say you thought he would be safe. So what surprised you about the treatment that he received?
I was concerned about Sean anyway, because having worked in the field for over 30 years, I couldn't conceive of a treatment program that wouldn't provide methadone as a maintenance drug. And Sean was on 120 milligrams of methadone. And when we were actually in the court, and I had spoken with the clinician on duty, and the judge, you know, told Sean that he was going to uphold the Section 35, Sean turned to me and said, "You know, I'm not going to be getting methadone, don't you?" And I thought that he was misunderstood. I thought that he misunderstood what the judge had said, because I couldn't conceive that there would be an opiate addiction or an opiate treatment program that did not provide medication-assisted treatment.
So, Robin, when your son Sean told you that, what was your reaction?
I thought that he was mistaken. I honest to goodness, I thought that he had misunderstood the judge. And when I left the treatment program, I was talking to somebody, and they said, "No, they don't provide methadone. They don't provide Suboxone."
And so, knowing that, how do you think that experience changed your son?
I think that Sean was already filled with guilt, and he was already filled with shame, because I know that he did not want to be a heroin addict. That was not a choice that he made.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the way he was treated was inhumane. I would equate it to almost being a prisoner of war, the kind of things that he talked about happening. He was not treated with dignity and respect. He did not receive any sort of addiction treatment while he was there. He did not meet up with a counselor. He was not given any kind of psychiatric oversight. His medical issues, I'm sure, were made much worse by the fact that he was on 120 milligrams of methadone and needed and was detoxing from that with no medication. And the way he described it is, he was in solitary confinement. He was in a turtle suit, and this was because he had run from the facility.
Robin, I want to just say again, thank you for sharing your story with us, because I can hear in your voice the difficulty and the pain here, and so I just again I want to say thank you for being so open about this with us, and I suicide is a difficult, complicated thing that you know, has many factors, including mental health, that you're telling us about, and so I just wonder, in your view, how all this impacted Sean and what went wrong for him?
Well, I think what went wrong is that, you know, there were several things that were wrong. I think being treated like a prisoner was wrong. Not receiving substance use, you know, addiction treatment, that was wrong. I think to be punished the way that he was wrong. I think that the courts not passing on the information about him having psychiatric and medical issues, that was a big problem. So I think that there were a lot of problems along the way.
And Robin, I know we had some technical changes here, and so thank you for sticking with us through that, and also this, again, very painful story. And I want to ask you, knowing what you know now, would you seek involuntary treatment for your son again?
You know, when I first started to work for the Section 35 program, because I had been in addictions treatment for a long time, and I thought that there were some really positive aspects of it. And one of the positive aspects is that it's very difficult for people to get treatment right now through the ordinary. We're still using systems that were around since the 90s to get people into treatment. So it's very difficult for people to get into treatment sometimes. So I thought that one of the things about the Section 35 program was that it would offer more people access to treatment. I think that the Department of Corrections has no business being in the addiction treatment field or providing any kind of addiction treatment. It's not what they do, and it's not what they should do. And my firm belief is that it should be taken out of the prison in Plymouth. I think that that's a horrendous program, and I think that there have been a lot of people that have been hurt there.
So you wouldn't have done it again?
I would not have done it if I thought that that's where he was going to go. It led to his kind of, there was a certain kind of death where he lost hope.
Yeah.
And where he felt like he'd never be the same person again. So there was that death. And then actually in September, he actually took his own life. Right. And he took his own life after being incarcerated without methadone.
You said your son Sean lost hope. And I'm just wondering, finally, what you would say to other families out there who are listening and perhaps dealing with a loved one who is struggling with mental health and addiction, and might also feel that they've lost hope. What would you say to them?
I would say to parents, you know, that you do the best that you can, that you try to connect with other people and talk to other people, and that you speak out. When there's a program such as the MassEd program, you speak out to help other parents and to help other people who are suffering from the disease of addiction.
Well, Robin Wallace, the mother of Sean Wallace, thank you for speaking out and speaking to us today on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
To hear more reporting on Sean Wallace's story and WBUR Deborah Becker's reporting on Section 35, visit our website, radioboston.org. And I should note that the State Department of Correction declined to be interviewed for Deborah Becker's story, but they did give WBUR a statement saying that its mission at the Massachusetts Alcohol and Substance Abuse Center is to promote public safety by providing a, quote, safe, secure, and structured environment for patients to safely detox. And listeners, if you or someone you know may be considering suicide, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. Or you can text the crisis text line at 741-741. Stay with us. There's more Radio Boston ahead. I'm Jamie Bologna.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Now, take a second here and imagine a small college town, especially here in New England. We can all picture them. They're full of vibrant streets and these quaint little squares, white churches maybe, a cafe, pizza joints, some bars, a theater, maybe even a cookie store or two. You know, that kind of New England-y feel that makes so many people love visiting and going to school here. But now we are seeing a series of small colleges closing their doors for good. And just last week, the College of St. Joseph in Rutland announced its impending closure, making it the third small private college to close in Vermont this year alone. So what do the college closings mean for their towns? Well, here to help me answer that question is Evan Horowitz. He's Director of Research and Communication at FCLT Global. It's a financial think tank. Hello, Evan.
Jamie, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, though I wish the topic were about new colleges springing up as opposed to stately colleges disappearing.
Well, yes, but we asked you here because you've crunched the numbers for us, and I appreciate that.
That's what I come in for.
So how significant is the higher education sector in New England, for New England?
Well, it's more significant here than just about anywhere else. I mean, the three states with the highest share of jobs in higher education are Vermont, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, in that order. It's not, you know, it's not the biggest sector in the world, but it is the biggest sector here, a bigger sector here than anywhere else in the country, which makes us more susceptible to college closings than other places. And it's particularly concentrated in some parts of the state.
So it's, where is it most concentrated in Massachusetts?
Well, the one place, won't surprise anybody, is Hampshire County. Think Amherst, UMass Amherst, well, Hampshire, Mount Holyoke, mm-hmm. All right, a variety of colleges out there. 7 out of every 100 jobs in that county are at colleges and universities, like 7% of the workforce. It is one of the biggest industries in the entire county. That's pretty substantial, and it makes them pretty vulnerable if colleges are going to be disappearing.
And in terms of why this is happening, you know, we've spoken with Catherine Newman on the show before and other folks that there were kind of
headed for a demographic cliff, right? After the Great Recession, there's sort of an anti-baby boom. What's the opposite of a baby boom?
Fewer babies. It's your generation. Your generation is doing this to the rest of us.
All right, Rob, make it too personal.
The fertility rate is down. Right? People are having smaller families, fewer kids. Immigration rate is not making up for that. Mm-hmm. And in certain parts of the country, like us, there isn't a big influx of movers either. We're not getting lots of people from the South moving to Massachusetts. In fact, it's all going the other way. So there's a sort of shrinking share of college-age kids, and that's going to get worse over time. So fewer people who need colleges, fewer colleges who can support them.
So in places where colleges employ something like 7% are 7% of the jobs, I mean, what's the impact when these colleges go away?
So you really want to think sort of separately in terms of like statewide impact and local impact.
Okay.
So for statewide stuff, I don't think you have to worry too much. I mean, Massachusetts, it's true, it's a state that has long relied on education and smarts to get us
wicked smarts
to get us, you know, moving forward. But we have lots of other industries. People can move between industries. That's okay. But when you have your biggest employer in a town disappear, that can take not years but decades or generation to find a proper recompense, a new industry. And you see this in manufacturing. Now, I'm not suggesting that, you know, the decline of higher education is going to be anything like the China shock that sucked a million manufacturing jobs out of the United States.
Well, some people are predicting that. I'm looking at Clayton Christensen from Harvard Business School saying, half of the schools are bound for bankruptcy in the coming decades.
I'm not saying it's going to be small. Manufacturing, which is always a bigger, more important sector of the economy. So when that disappears from a town, that town is debilitated. Now, there are a few towns that really could be debilitated by a loss of a college, where the college is the main employer for an entire town. So statewide, I don't think it's a big economic deal. But for particular locales in Vermont, in western Massachusetts, it could be really dramatic.
Like dramatic in terms of Lawrence and Lowell and when the mills moved out type dramatic? Or?
Well, you can think of that as the example. When the mills moved out, it took a generation to find new footing for some of these towns. Some of these cities, gateway cities, have not found new footing. So I don't think we're talking about cities of that size. I think you should really think of rural towns, rural college-based towns, as being the most vulnerable, because there are sort of, you know, college campuses in New England have, as you mentioned in the intro, this sort of bucolic reputation and setting.
Magical vision, yeah.
But that comes
with... It might
not
be real, but...
No, but that comes with like a dearth of people. There's a reason they have this people. People aren't around. It's a small town. It's not densely populated. But that means they are by far the dominant employer. When they disappear, those towns can shutter. That's the real risk.
So speaking of a small town and a local community that is currently facing the closure of a small college, you know, we mentioned closures in Vermont, and earlier this month, Southern Vermont College is one of the three that announced that there's no way forward for the school, so they'd be leaving the town of Bennington, facing a future without them. And so I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. It's Matt Harrington. He's the executive director of the Chamber of Commerce in Bennington, Vermont. Matt, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Jamie. Thanks for having me.
So you've been listening here to this conversation. As Evan says, it's the small towns, perhaps like yours, that would suffer the most. What are you facing?
Yeah, I think when I've spoken to SVC and some of their leadership, they're probably about the third or fourth largest employer, and the other employers of the town, the hospital and the veterans home, are huge compared to them. So I don't think they're close in line in the third or fourth spot, but I think when you're looking at a rural town like Bennington, SVC bringing in about 150 professionals, that does have an impact on the town.
So tell us a little bit more about Bennington, Vermont, for the folks who don't necessarily know about it.
So it's in the southwesternmost corner of Vermont. So picture, you know, that great picture of Vermont. We're in the south corner. We are bordering right next to New York. And so if you think of like Albany, the capital region, we're an hour outside of Albany. And we're also bordering Massachusetts. And so we're close to Williamstown, Massachusetts. And we're about three and a half hours outside of Boston if you were to head kind of due west, a little bit north. So you'd end up in this small town, 15,000 people. And then, of course, there are hamlet towns that are, you know, very very prolific in Vermont. So not only Bennington is affected, but the hamlet towns that also surround Bennington, be it Arlington, Pownall, Shaftesbury, all those towns that surround Bennington are also impacted. you know, I think you guys brought up the idea of the mills and manufacturing. Of course, Bennington in Vermont with its textile mills went through that era of bringing those mills down. And then we went through the manufacturing era of the 90s where it kind of also halted. So we've gone through our iterations of disruption. And, so this is kind of the next one that's up.
And yeah, so the next one that's up, it sounds like a beautiful place, by the way. But so if Southern Vermont College had 400 total students, what's the impact of this school closing on your town?
Yeah, well, I always kind of use the example of the pizza shop owner, and I actually know, just like Vermont, you know your local pizza shop owner. And the pizza shop owner, you know, not only was supplying pizza to the students, he was using the students to help run his shop. Mm-hmm. And then you have to think about the trickle-down of that. So he gets his cheese locally, and he gets his meat locally, and he makes his dough, and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, you start to see the trickle-down. So I know shops like that, pizza shops, coffee shops, of course, are notorious for college kids. All those places are absolutely going to feel the impact, not to mention that this was a strong college that had a strong partnership with the local hospital.
And you mentioned the hospital.
It's a pretty big hospital, and so I believe they said something like 90 students were either going through, you know, their kind of internship program, or they had been part of that college as they were graduating. So even the hospital, who's the largest employer in the region, is going to feel the effect of Southern Vermont College's closure.
So what types of talks or what is the town thinking about in terms of how to fill that void that will be left by the exit of Southern Vermont College?
Right. Well, I think what the town leadership, including myself and some other regional development entities and agencies, and of course the Department of Labor has been involved, and then, you know, just our whole government, what we've tried to first educate our citizens on is the fact that this is not a Bennington phenomenon, and it's not even really a Vermont phenomenon. You know, we usually reference Clayton Christensen, Harvard professor that just came out and said pretty much that in the next decade, in the next 10 years, half of all colleges won't exist. And so, you know, it's not just even a New England thing, although I think I also read a statistic that 25% of those, 50%, is going to be in the Northeast, just because we're so dense with educational systems in the Northeast. But, you know, this is just a matter of disruption, and disruption because of technology and online education, and then just the idea of kind of hybrid learning. You know, we have as many kids watching YouTube and Udacity and Khan University, and of course, you know, now we're seeing the master class on Facebook. So there's all these disruptors in the marketplace that makes a person go, if I can get my degree for pennies on the dollar cheaper than a university or a college, then that may be the wave of the future. So first, for us, it's about educating our community that it's not just us. Yeah. I think the second part, and I was just reading this, I know Thomas Friedman just wrote a piece about building complex adaptive coalitions. And so part of that is kind of coming to a reality. We're all going through our loss cycle, right? Not unlike when you lose a loved one, we're losing a college, and so we've got to go through denial and isolation and anger, and then we've got to bargain for its, you know, existence. And then, of course, depression hits. But eventually we have to accept that this college isn't going to come back. And so these complex adaptive coalitions make that, you know, the community leaders, everybody from social entrepreneurs to philanthropists to your local government should be working together.
Isn't Vermont offering money for young people to, or anyone, I guess, to move to Vermont into this grant program where they can work remotely, get $10,000?
So there's the remote worker grant that 47 people just moved to Vermont that received some version of that. So it was up to $10,000. And it included paying for your Wi-Fi connection or paying for your travel expenses. I think those are some of the innovative things that come out of that coalition. So it's ideas like that loan or grant program, or it could be our stay-to-stay program, and that's also been very popular. And those are just pilot programs, so those haven't even ramped up. I think we've got to shoot our bullets before we shoot cannonballs okay, let's try out, you know, 50 different things that might encourage people to move here. Which ones are sticking or hitting? and then let's aim our energies and resources and muscles to that.
So Evan Horowitz, Director of Research and Communication at FCLT Global, I haven't forgotten about you. What's your reaction to what you're hearing from Matt Harrington up in Vermont?
Well, it's heartening to hear about pilot programs, and I think the experimentation is important here because the bust is coming, right? This is not like some hypothetical thing. More colleges are going to close, and the question really is, should we do anything about it? What should we do about it? There's an argument that we should maybe let them close. Maybe this is just we have too many and it's best not to keep zombie colleges alive, just so they can keep them alive. Alternatively, if they are real staples of communities, maybe there has to be some kind of intervention to save the community or save the colleges. And trying out pilot programs is a good way to start thinking about how best to do that. Who should manage it? Mayors, states, regions, federal government.
And Matt Harrington, I'm wondering from your perspective, you know, this isn't the only college that's in Bennington. There's also Bennington College. So do you know anything about the health of Bennington College?
Well, I know they just launched a $150 million campaign last week. I think Bennington College is quite healthy. And when I talked to President Evans, who was the president of SVC, I think you're just looking at completely different demographics. I don't think Bennington College is impervious. But what you have to recognize is that Southern Vermont College was a first-generation and lower-income college, and so there wasn't the reserves and there wasn't the wealthy donors or even wealthy families that you could go to for that salvation. I you know, go back to that article that says half of all colleges won't exist in 10 years. That the day may be coming, but I think the Bennington Colleges and for sure the Harvards and Yales and Princetons of the world have a little bit more time to figure out this disruption. I think the small
and more money,
colleges,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
We just have a couple of seconds left here. I just want to quickly ask both of you: are you hopeful then moving forward? I'll start with you, Matt Harrington.
Oh, of course. I think we have to be hopeful that there's no other option. And so this is a good exercise for us on how we pivot and deal with disruption. And then where do we move forward from?
Evan Horowitz?
I'm hopeful about one thing, which is that reduced demand for college brings reduced price pressure, upward price pressure on tuition. Maybe finally tuition will come under control.
And more spots for the few students that are still left.
That would be nice. I do have a daughter who will be going to college in 7 years. Spots are good.
There you go. That's Evan Horowitz. He's the Director of Research and Communication at FCLT Global. It's a financial think tank. Evan, thanks for coming in.
It's always a pleasure, Jamie.
And Matt Harrington. He's the Executive Director of the Chamber of Commerce in Bennington, Vermont. Matt, thanks for joining us and giving us your perspective. Stick with us, listeners. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. No collusion, no exoneration. That, in a nutshell, is Attorney General William Barr's summary of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into whether the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government to influence the 2016 election. The investigation lasted 22 months and ignited one media firestorm after another.
We haven't ever had to reckon with the possibility that somebody has ascended to the presidency of the United States to serve the interests of another country rather than our own.
For all the layers, all the lies in this lasagna of lies, keep it simple. Two questions will reveal much of what we need to know. Why did he and his folks lie about Russia? And why did he do so much to mess with a probe that he keeps saying could never hurt him?
Single most serious scandal in the history of the United States. Was the president of the United States an agent of an enemy of the United States? Look, this technically eclipses Benedict Arnold.
So a little sampling there of MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, CNN's Chris Cuomo, and analyst Malcolm Nance on MSNBC. So some journalists, commentators, and even top Democrats are faced with the prospect of defending their condemnation of the president over the last 2 years. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said this on the Today Show yesterday.
I think Democrats and the liberal media owe the president and they owe the American people an apology. They wasted 2 years and created a massive disruption and distraction from things that people that impact everyone's day-to-day life.
So we want to know, should members of the media and some Democrats do exactly that, apologize? And joining me now in studio to get at this question is Joe Battenfeld. He's political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Jamie.
Also with us in studio is WBUR senior news analyst John Carroll. He's the man behind the blog, It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. John, thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
And listeners, we want to hear from you on this. Did the media get it all wrong all along? Or were journalists just doing their jobs and holding those in power accountable? Or is it, as Matt Taibbi puts it, is Russiagate this generation's weapons of mass destruction scandal? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Twitter at Radio Boston. And before we get into this, I just want to note that as of right now, we only have Attorney General Barr's summary. We don't yet have any sort of redacted version of the full report. But Joe, I want to start with you because you wrote about this in the Herald, what your reaction was to the summary of the report and what it signals for President Trump.
Well, I think for President Trump, it obviously gives him a huge opportunity in the next election to go around the country and say, I was falsely accused, gin up his supporters, and make the Democrats look bad. I mean, there's no doubt about it that he's going to use it in his reelection, even though his advisors, I guess, are trying to get him to tamp down the gloating a little bit. That's impossible. So it's going to help him politically. We don't know what's in the rest of the report, so I should add that, you know, there's definitely going to be some damning information in that report if it gets released. But I think the overriding factor is the no collusion part. And that's the thing that he's going to go around to the country. And I think, you know, a lot of people in this country, I mean, a lot of Democrats are definitely going to be against Trump no matter what. But there's a lot of people in the middle ground in this country who are kind of sick of this whole collusion thing. And they want to move on from it. And I think it would be wise for Democrats to heed that advice.
Well, and he's been saying it all along, right? I think even last week he was shaking hands with folks and saying, no collusion, no collusion.
Yeah.
He's been saying this for months. And in the Herald, Joe, you laid blame on Democrats and the media, saying, quote, Democrats relying on conspiracy theories and false media reporting overshot their target by a wide margin.
Yeah, a lot of this was based on this Steele dossier. That's what a lot of this collusion stuff got started. And it was propagated by others, by Obama administration officials that were out there. So, you know, I think there was a little, and the media was complicit in this because there was, I think you mentioned Matt Taibbi.
Yeah.
His column, he talked about there were
Rolling Stone Associate Editor. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, very legitimate journalist, actually a kind of a liberal journalist. And he was saying he documented 50 cases of stories that were outright wrong and false and had to be corrected.
But at the same time here, Joe, we've got, you know, 8 Americans charged who are affiliated with Trump,
yeah.
George Papadopoulos and Manafort, others, 13 Russians, 12 Russian intelligence officers. I mean, it's not like there wasn't any smoke here.
No, I mean, but it was not with collusion. You know, none of those people were charged with collusion or had anything to do with collusion. So I think, you know, a lot of it was, you know, lying to Congress or lying to the FBI about it. So, you know, that didn't help matters any when you have Trump administration people or Trump campaign people lying about their role in it. And I think that caused a lot of the smoke to come out. But you know, none of those charges were collusion. And, you know, that's what people were waiting for.
John Carroll, I want to bring you into this conversation. What are you seeing in this?
Well, first of all, I don't think it was just the Steele dossier that you know, set this off. I think there were a number, about 100, contacts between Trump-related people and Russians. So I think there's something there. I would say that, you know, it's good news to know that the President of the United States is not an agent of a foreign power, and that's a good outcome. I think you look at the loose ends, though, that we have here, and that's a whole different thing. But just to talk about the media for a minute,
yes.
There is no the media. There's an information and news spectrum that ranges from Twitter to Time magazine. And there are two parts of that spectrum, and one is the reporting part and one is the opinion part. And I think the opinion part has a lot to answer for. The reporting part, I think, you know, Joe rightly points out, Taibbi's piece has, you know, 50 examples. News organizations make mistakes. You know, these happen to be mistakes that landed on one side of the ideological spectrum. And so that's problematic, no question.
Well, and, you know, mistakes that lead to a narrative.
Right. But, you know, overall, the reporting was reasonable for the most part. You can pick out the mistakes that CNN, MSNBC made, but the reporting overall was solid in many cases in the mainstream traditional media. And you have to separate the Rachel Maddows from the New York Times to really, I think, get a legitimate and reasonable view of the media performance.
We're talking with Joe Battenfeld. He's a political columnist at the Boston Herald, and John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst. And we're taking your calls. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Do you think the media needs to apologize for its coverage of the whole Mueller, Russiagate, whatever you want to call it? 1-800-423-8255. I want to take a call here from Joe in Reading. Joe, welcome to Radio Boston. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Trump is the one that's responsible for the investigation. From the beginning, when Obama found out about the hacking by Russia, he confronted Putin. Putin denied it. He didn't believe him. And then he told his intelligence to tell the incoming president so he knew. Trump ignored it. Trump kept siding with Putin, agreed Putin when he said, no, we didn't do it. Trump kept believing it. Everybody says, why does he keep believing Russia?
He went against his own intelligence agencies.
And he goes
conclusions,
to the Oval
right?
Office and tells the Russian ambassador that the reason he got rid of Comey was because of the Russian investigation. So there was plenty of reason why people had doubts. What does Russia have on this guy? Why is he doing this? If he had been a normal president, we never would have had this. It was all his doing.
All right, Joe and Redding, thank you. We've got that, and I want to put it to Joe Battenfeld. What do you make of Joe's comments?
Well, I don't think Trump started the investigation. I think
But Joe's larger point of
right.
the president could have said, "Look, I agree with the intelligence agencies on meddling in the election, and I did no collusion, but we've got to look into this, and I support the investigation."
Right. That was Trump being Trump for the most part. Him basically, you know, going against his intelligence. And I think a lot of it was stubbornness on his part because he was like, there's no collusion, there's no collusion. And he was doing it to almost prove a point to be in Putin's corner on this. So it was not a wise move by him if he wanted to keep the stories down. But I think, you know, that doesn't mean he's responsible for the investigation. The investigation actually started, you know, way before that.
John.
So I think one of the issues we have to deal with here is the obstruction issue. You know, Robert Mueller comes down and says, I can't make a call on obstruction of justice, whether there was or not. And he basically passes it down to Bill Barr to make the decision. Bill Barr has already been on the record saying there's no obstruction if there's no underlying crime. So basically, there's no obstruction because there's no collusion.
But that was his reading of the law, right?
That was his reading. Why Mueller kicked the can down to Barr is a really good question, because he was appointed to take this out of the political realm. Now it's in the political realm. But the issue could be obstruction, because what Trump was really worried about is the legitimacy of his presidency. And if it's proven, and Mueller seems to have proven it pretty conclusively, that the Russians interfered with the election, then it calls into question whether Trump is illegitimately in the office. And that could be the basic problem that he wanted to make go away. And that could be the basis for another look at obstruction. I'm not saying that that is the case, but all Barr said was there's no underlying crime of collusion. Didn't say there's no other underlying crime. And remember, Donald Trump is already an unindicted co-conspirator in another investigation that involved Michael Cohen. So the idea that there was no crime at all and no obstruction at all, I think that's still up in the air. I don't think that's settled at all.
But do Democrats risk you know, for lack of a better term here, political goodwill by continuing to push.
I think, from a strategic standpoint, pushing on collusion is a loser, a total loser. I mean, if they want to push on something, they might want to consider pushing on corruption. But collusion is going to get them nowhere, and all it's going to do is get everybody dug in deeper into these intractable positions that they have. So I think that's baked in at this point, and I think that to pursue collusion. On the other hand, you know, the fact that Mueller left the door open, you know, basically said this is a coin flip, gives the Democrats some kind of justification in their minds anyway to continue going after collusion. I just don't think it's going to work for
them. Well, and we should note that there are other investigations going on in the Southern District of New York and other places, Virginia. But Joe, you write in your piece that this could, if the Democrats play it wrong, guarantee a re-election for President
Trump. Yeah, if they continue to push, even on obstruction, I mean, there is a point to be made that how do you obstruct justice when there was no crime, underlying crime, that occurred? So, you know, how do you get a conviction with that? So even if they push that, it's very unlikely they're going to get barred to lodge charges against anybody. It's very unlikely they're going to get even any other prosecutors to lodge charges. So why pursue the case if it's not going to end up with anybody being indicted? I mean, it's just going to continually reinforce the notion with the American people that this is, something that they don't really care so much about, and they'd much rather talk about health care. All the polls show it. If you talk to voters out there, they much rather talk about health care, housing, other issues like that, and they're just kind of sick of this. So I think, you know, Democrats are, that's why I said the Democrats are risking the election by continuing to push on it, because people are kind of fed up with it.
We're talking about whether the media, others, need to apologize for its coverage of the Russia probe. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to George in Brookline. George, you're next.
Hi. I don't know if the media should apologize, but I think they should explore why there is all this hype about Russian interference in U.S. elections. According to Carnegie Mellon University experts, from 1946 to 2000, the United States interfered more than 80 times with the elections of other countries. In fact, I think this was originally reported on NPR 2 years ago. So I'm always bemused by why everybody is so hepped up about Russian interference in our elections.
But George, you know, as my mother reminds me, if everyone else is jumping off a bridge, you know, maybe you shouldn't go do that. And I'm just thinking, you know, sure, maybe the United States has meddled in other elections, but that doesn't make it right to happen in our elections.
No, of course not. And it's not maybe. And that's a conservative estimate, 80 times. And I'm not talking about, you know, the last 20 years or where we've actually overthrown democratically elected representatives in other countries. So all I'm saying is we need to put things in perspective, and that's what I think the media should do. Put it in some kind of perspective. This is nothing to get all worked up about.
George, thank you so much for your call. That's what we're trying to do here, put it into perspective. Let's get another call in. Denise from Attleboro, you're next on Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think that until the public has an opportunity to see every single page of the Mueller report, maybe collusion is not the case, but there's definitely obstruction of justice there. Every time he opens his mouth, he's doing something like that. And where there may have been some missteps by the media, I think they're still spot on to hold his feet to the fire. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for calling, Denise. John, your response to our two callers, George and Denise, there.
Well, I mean, you know, whataboutism aside, I think it's pretty incontrovertible that the Russians interfered in the 2016 presidential election. So one of the questions is, how do you keep that from happening again in 2020? That should be a major concern, not only of the politicians, but of the American people as well. The other thing is, there are two tracks here. One track is the legal track, and there are still ongoing investigations, the Southern District of New York, the New York Attorney General. the Department of Justice has a policy of not indicting a sitting president, but the SDNY doesn't have that policy. So there's that to be laid out. And then the other part is impeachment. Impeachment is not a legal issue. Impeachment is a political issue. And I'm not supporting it.
But it could also be a political third rail, right?
Absolutely. It turned out that way, certainly, in the case of Bill Clinton. So, you know, these are two different tracks that have two different dynamics that have to be considered. To lump them together is probably not the the best idea, because they're going to play out in completely different ways.
Joe?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to kick Trump out of office, find a good candidate and talk about issues that people care about. That would be my advice to Democrats. And as far as the media goes, though, I think, you know, there should be a reckoning for the media. How much of this was driven by ratings or money? You know, CNN, MSNBC, that's pretty much, that was their cottage industry, was the Russiagate. So, you know, a lot of it, people, I think people should go back and take a look at this.
John?
Yeah, just to be fair and balanced, Fox News was weighing in, too, making money and getting ratings. And, you know, it's interesting because Robert Mueller was this, a person who represented the worst of the deep state until he didn't. And now all of a sudden, with this report, or what we know of the report, Robert Mueller is a mensch on Fox News. So you know, it depends on how you hold it up to the light.
There are a million cases of whataboutism, right? I mean, you could think about the whole birther movement and President Obama's birth certificate and Fox News in the last administration. So, but I want to take another call here. We have Adam from Sutton. Adam, you're on Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks very much. As to the question about whether or not the media should apologize to us or not, I don't expect the pundit class, at least, to apologize to us at this point, because I've already learned to tune them out. And I mean, specious arguments along the lines of, well, you know, how can you obstruct justice when there was no underlying crime, or perfect examples of those sorts of, you know, bits of misinformation that I really, really don't appreciate. But no need to apologize. I've learned to ignore you. But in the larger case, what I would really appreciate from the media is to keep up the heat on the government. They need to make the Mueller report completely 100% transparent to the American people. I would not be myself terribly, you know, disposed to accept arguments along the lines that some of these things need to be redacted. These are extremely important questions about, you know, the conduct of our government, and to the extent that they may have been manipulated by a foreign power that is our enemy. And the American people deserve 100% transparency on this issue. If there was no crime, great. If there was, there's nothing to hide. If there was, we need to know about it.
Well, Adam, and to that point, you know, President Trump has said he supports releasing the report, and, you know, as do the Massachusetts delegation and others, they're pushing to have it released by April 2nd. So that does seem like a thing that brings both sides together on this, Adam.
Yeah, maybe. Trump lies. I'll believe it when I see it.
All right. Well, thanks for calling, Adam. We just have a few minutes here, but respond to Adam's points there, John Carroll.
Well, I'm glad I don't have to apologize to Adam. That's that's a relief. But I think that there are a lot of unanswered questions. Unfortunately, what we have here right now is just one more national Rorschach test, and everybody is seeing what they want to see in it. And this last 3 years has been a masterclass in confirmation bias. And I think that people are pretty much set in their opinions and what they're going to believe and not believe. And so that's one of the problems, is if there's any way to get back to a time when there were some mutually agreed upon facts and then people disputed that was traditional public discourse. I'm not seeing that happen anywhere at this point, or virtually anywhere. And I think that that's one of the problems, is that there is no basis for conversation anymore. And so nothing is really going to be resolved in any significant way.
Joe Battenfeld, what do you think? Is this a reflection of where we are as a country, the MSNBC viewers versus the Fox viewers all sort of going off in their little bubbles?
Yeah, partly. But there are some people out there, swing voters in swing states, who, you know, don't necessarily fall into those two camps. And those are going to be the key voters in the 2020 election. This was the reason why Democrats won so big in 2018, was because they got those swing voters in a lot of those states. And it was because they were talking about stuff like health care and protecting, you know, Obamacare and on issues. They weren't talking, you know, the people that won election were talking about those issues, you know, instead of impeachment. So I think, you know, they Democrats would be wise to look at it and say, hey, this was a roadmap to victory.
So in our last 30 seconds that we have here, how can we come together, John Carroll? Let's fix it all in 30 seconds.
Yeah, I'm not sure how we can come together. I think probably a good meal and some fine Chianti would help. But beyond that, I'm not really sure at this point.
Blatant pandering to me right there, John.
There you go.
Thank you. Joe?
And there's nothing wrong with having differences. You know, people, I just think, you know, the discourse has gotten out of hand, and it would be nice if that improved a little bit.
Well, that's what we're trying to do here on Radio Boston. Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst and the blogger behind It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. John, thanks for coming in as well.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zukoff, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Jamie Bologna. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.